Welcome to Eastern Standard, a broadcast service of Eastern Kentucky University, produced with the support of One, the Alltech Ideas Conference, and Dynamics Productions. I'm Tom Martin, and in this hour, we know what our voices are saying, but what about our body language? A campaign to solarize Kentucky, urban and rural. And we'll fill you in on the Ralph Steadman exhibition coming to the UK Arts Museum. First, last November, the Kentucky Center for Investigative Reporting told us about shortcomings in Kentucky's worker safety program. The center found that Kentucky OSHA had failed to properly investigate nearly every fatality in a two-year period. Inspectors had failed to interview witnesses, missed safety issues, and in some cases, improperly blamed the employee for their own death. Throughout the reporting of that series, many people pointed to the same problem: high rates of staff turnover that they blamed on low salaries. KYCIR's Eleanor Klibanoff did the research to find out how Kentucky salaries compare to the private sector and to surrounding states.
It's a good time to be a college graduate with a degree in occupational safety and health.
We have Amazon come and recruit. We have Georgia Pacific come and recruit. Marathon Petroleum. You know, they come down and they're like, we want to hire you, college graduate, and pay you, you know, 50, 60 starting out.
David Stumbo teaches occupational safety and health at Eastern Kentucky University. He also spent 20 years working for Kentucky's state-run OSHA program, KIOSH. But when students ask him about working for the state, he's honest.
It's really hard to encourage them because I have to say, you're not going to be able to pay off your student loans and live by yourself. You'll have to live at home, or I don't know how you'll live. You know, paycheck to paycheck is not something you want to advocate.
The state pays entry-level compliance officers about $30,000 a year. That's a lot less than the private sector. But it's also a lot less than the public sector in other states. Kentucky pays new inspectors less than all the surrounding states, and the gap only widens the longer an inspector stays on the job. In Virginia, safety inspectors start at $36,000 a year. In Indiana, it's $42,000. And in Tennessee, they start at $45,000, which increases to $50,000 and then $57,000 after each subsequent year on the job.
Can't hardly have a successful program. I'll just say you cannot have a successful program unless you have a qualified, well-compensated staff to do the work, because that's where the difference is made.
Steve Hawkins is the administrator for the Tennessee OSHA state plan. He said his agency has raised salaries twice in the last 2 years to slow the rates of staff turnover. He thinks it's an investment that will pay off.
It takes us somewhere between 12 to 18 months to train a person to do this job. And so if you're not able to keep a staff member at least 5 years, you hardly get any return on the time and money invested.
Almost all of the 28 state-run OSHA plans struggle with staff turnover. Like Tennessee, other states, including Indiana and North Carolina, have recently increased salaries to try to slow the exodus of employees who work a year or two for the state just to take their skills and training to private companies. But in Kentucky, Stumbo says,
the public sector is funding a great training program for the private sector.
For those who do stay, there's little incentive to rise through the ranks. Kentucky's highest paid safety inspector makes $55,000 a year. That job requires 5 years of experience and includes supervising other inspectors. In neighboring Tennessee, a similar job can pay more than $80,000 a year. By the end of their second year on the job, all the inspectors working for Steve Hawkins in Tennessee will be out-earning KIOSH's highest-paid employee.
I would have a very difficult job attracting talent and running this agency at the salary levels that Kentucky OSHA is paying.
This isn't a new problem. A federal report in 2013 put Kentucky's worker safety salaries lower than any other locally run program except Puerto Rico. Year after year in its federal audits, the Kentucky Labor Cabinet has blamed staff turnover for many of the program's shortcomings. For many experts and leaders of similar programs in surrounding states, the answer is simple: pay people more money. Acting Labor Secretary David Dickerson declined an interview request, but in a statement, he acknowledged that Kentucky's salaries had fallen behind and said the agency was considering ways to incentivize employees, including possibly increasing salaries. For the Kentucky Center for Investigative Reporting, I'm Eleanor Klibanoff.
A week after this story first ran, the Kentucky Labor Cabinet announced that it would be raising salaries for occupational safety and health inspectors. The state said it had performed its own assessment and hoped the raises would help keep Kentucky competitive with similar programs in neighboring states. The Labor Cabinet declined to provide additional specifics about the raises. Jeff Young has a follow-up on a recent report about the surge in black lung disease and the difficulties survivors have faced in receiving federal benefits. A coalition of black lung clinics is calling for action from federal regulators, but as Jeff reports, the government's top mine safety official says he has no plans to change the rules on dust exposure.
The National Coalition of Black Lung Clinics said in a statement that the federal government has more than enough data on the risks of current mining practices to justify implementing new measures. Specifically, the coalition wants better control of the dust generated when miners cut into rock containing silica and quartz. As NPR's investigation shows, health advisors urged tighter controls on that dust decades ago. Coalition member Debbie Wills of Cedar Grove, West Virginia, says it's time for the Mine Safety and Health Administration, or MSHA, to act.
We would like MSHA to have a silica standard and testing to ensure that that standard is really being met.
But in a recent call with mining industry stakeholders, MSHA Director David Zatazzolo defended the current regulations.
What we do is what MSHA is supposed to do, which is enforce the law.
Zatazzolo says changes made during the Obama administration strengthened coal dust standards and introduced new monitoring technology.
That has lowered miners' exposure, and we have the proof of that.
Zatazzolo says the number of dust samples that show high levels of exposure have dropped. However, the new devices do not specifically monitor for dust from quartz or silica, and Wills is concerned that miners will continue to be exposed to unsafe levels.
I don't think that's going to change the amount of disease and the severity of the disease.
Wills and the Clinic Coalition are not alone in that concern. A June report from the National Academy of Sciences called for a, quote, fundamental shift in the way the mining industry controls dust exposures in order to prevent lung disease among coal miners. For the Ohio Valley Resource, I'm Jeff Young.
In another report from our friends at the Ohio Valley Resource, the coal industry and its out-of-work miners have been important symbols for President Trump. But as Brittany Patterson tells us, after 2 years under Trump, more coal power plants are closing down and coal employment is at an all-time low.
To talk about coal, President Trump likes to come to the Ohio Valley. Here he is speaking at a November rally in Huntington, West Virginia.
We've ended the war on beautiful, clean coal, and we're putting our coal miners back to work. That you know better than anybody.
But federal data tell a different story. Preliminary figures for 2018 show fewer than 81,000 people were employed by mine operators and contractors. That's a record low, and about 1,000 fewer than were employed by coal in the last year of the Obama administration. Industry analysts say Trump's looser environmental rules have not helped.
So we had some pretty significant regulatory rollbacks in 2018, including the replacement of the Clean Power Plan with a new rule by the Trump administration.
That's Trevor Hauser, a coal analyst at the independent research company Rhodium Group.
2018 was a record year in terms of coal plant retirements. So we're closing more coal plants than we ever have in the past, and there is no indication on the horizon that any utility in the country is planning on building a new coal-fired power plant, even under the current, more relaxed regulatory environment.
Here in the Ohio Valley, Utility First Energy Solutions declared bankruptcy. Then it announced it would close two coal-fired power plants, one in Pennsylvania and one in Ohio. Another of its plants in West Virginia will close by 2022. Another major utility, American Electric Power, announced it was moving up the closure date for one of its Ohio coal plants. These closures mean there are fewer places to sell coal burned for electricity. That concerns Jason Bostick with the West Virginia Coal Association.
you look at the share of where the coal was headed, the domestic utility market for West Virginia coal continues to decline, and that's extremely concerning.
Nationwide and here in the Ohio Valley, the amount of coal mined dropped to the lowest level in nearly 40 years. Coal exports, however, were up, specifically the kind used to make steel. The industry calls that metallurgical, or met coal for short. In places like West Virginia, overseas demand for met coal pushed production up.
Thank heavens for an increased domestic steel industry and a whole lot of international coal exports.
To meet that demand, some mines, especially in West Virginia and Virginia, have reopened. Federal data show West Virginia mines added a little over 500 jobs in 2018. Tom McLaughlin trains coal miners in Northern Virginia, where some met coal mines have ramped up production. He says he's been busy since Trump took office.
Well, as soon as Trump got elected, it was like somebody taking the finger out of the dam. There was all kinds of activity, including especially the training, and it's held up fairly well since.
But even in West Virginia, where things have looked slightly better for the industry, there were also some high-profile mine closures. A mine in Wyoming County shut its doors in October, putting about 400 miners out of work. And there's a lot of indications that that international demand for met coal, especially by China, is cooling off. Here's Hauser again.
2019, we have some pretty troubling signs about the outlook for the Chinese economy this coming year, and that could take the wind out of the sails of the metallurgical coal market pretty quickly.
It's possible that West Virginia's bounce in production could be a brief one. Elsewhere around the Ohio Valley, coal employment has been stagnant at best. Ohio mines added just 16 jobs last year, and Kentucky lost almost 400 jobs. Retired Kentucky miner Larry Miller says that doesn't surprise him. He says he never thought there was anything Trump could do.
So it's a it's a matter of economics. I don't think it's sustainable. And I really don't think that the EPA, the relaxing of the rules might help some, but I don't think it's the main driver for the job loss.
Miller worked for more than two decades underground and says he made a good living. But he says he's seeing firsthand that coal is no longer an economic source of electricity. For example, near his slice of Western Kentucky, a group of utilities is installing a large-scale solar farm.
I think coal is pretty much, it's not going to be gone, but it's not going to be the economic engine that it once was. And I made a good living in coal for a long time, and I liked it, so I don't take pleasure in saying that.
The U.S. Energy Information Administration recently adjusted down its coal forecast. It expects coal production to hit a record low in 2019. For the Ohio Valley Resource, I'm Brittany Patterson.
One project that had been touted as a major catalyst for jumpstarting a post-coal Eastern Kentucky economy has fallen through.
Honestly, it's heartbreaking.
State Representative Angie Hatton of Whitesburg on Enerblue's suspension of plans to build a $372 million battery manufacturing plant and bring 875 jobs to Pikeville.
We needed those jobs so very badly.
So what happened?
It has nothing to do with Eastern Kentucky. There is just some issues internally there, some investor issues.
Salyersville Representative John Blatton says the company's primary investor, citing unexpected geopolitical factors, withdrew support of the project. Earlier, the company's former CEO said the ground at the industrial park where the plant would be located proved difficult to build on, and soil work to make the ground viable would cost about $30 million.
They are going to move forward and begin more than likely the initial phase in another location. They really need a facility that's ready to move into based on the loss of these investors, and they have some production deadlines, and the cost and the time to get the site ready is going to cause a huge delay and be very expensive. So we're hopeful that eventually once they get up and they get running, as they begin to make expansions, that we'll see a portion of Enerblue still end up somewhere down the road in Pike County.
Coming up after the break, Solarizing Lexington, Wordless Debate, and The Art of Ralph Steadman. I'm Tom Martin, and you're listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.
Eastern Standard is made possible by One, the Alltech Ideas Conference, a global nexus of innovation for the future of food and the farm. Attendees are future thinkers who view technology as transformative opportunity for their business and lives. They share a belief in the boundless power of one idea to change everything. The 35th Annual Conference, 119, is May 19th through the 21st, 2019, in Lexington. Learn more at one.alltech.com.
Major support for Eastern Standard on WEKU is provided by the law firm Hicks & Funson. Kentucky lawyers Josh Hicks, Greg Funson, and Shannon Church provide legal advice and representation in the areas of personal injury, catastrophic accident, and immigration law. Learn more at hfkylawyers.com. Eastern Standard continues with Tom Martin.
In a time when the most reliable science available to us is sounding alarms about changes taking place in the Earth's climate, about the probable causes, about the consequences, renewable energy sources such as solar are gaining traction. Here's how that's playing out in one city in our region. Last fall, the Lexington-Fayette Urban County Council passed a resolution supporting the growth of solar energy and the development of strategies to make that happen. It was an initiative taken before the council by Solarize Lexington, a group of local solar energy advocates and installers, and they're beginning a series of workshops about energy use, solar installation, and how to control your utility bills. And here to tell us more about that is Steve Ricketts, co-owner of Solar Energy Solutions and a member of the Kentucky Solar Industry Association. Thanks for joining us, Steve.
Oh, it's a real pleasure to be here.
So do I understand that Solarize Lexington is modeled after similar programs in Ohio and Indiana?
Yes, it's a real transfer of best practice. There's something like 13 cities in Indiana now that have adopted this community bulk buying approach to giving people access to the cheapest possible solar. We thought, well, it's worked for the last 5 years in Indiana. Let's just kind of lift and transfer and see if this could work in Lexington.
What kind of results are they seeing?
In most cities that have tried it, you know, the early years have been a slow build, but they're at the state now where they've, through these campaigns, nearly doubled the amount of residential solar in Indiana. So pretty impressive.
Let's look at some of the strategies that are being advanced by Solarize Lexington, and I'll ask you to comment on each of these as I understand them. First, supporting solar for new construction and in city government buildings.
No, I mean, city government buildings are typically heavy energy kind of users. The campaign itself, Solarize Lexington, is open not only to your average kind of homeowner or your small business owner, but also to the city itself, who's been very supportive of this campaign. So they equally can benefit from significant discounts on putting it on individual city buildings. They've often got great flat roofs. They're often unshaded, so it can be mini power stations.
I see another one here is about improving the permitting process for commercial and industrial solar installations, which implies that there's a problem there.
Yes. I mean, with solar being such a relatively new industry in this state, we often find, with the best will, a lot of the building code and standard agencies, the electrical standard agencies, are perhaps not fully caught up on how to execute solar and to what specifications. So, just doing your home and putting solar on your home can sometimes be a slow process, to get it permitted. And certainly to get it inspected, can take more weeks than we'd like. So for a job that takes 2 to 3 days, you can often add 3 to 4 weeks of permitting and inspection afterwards.
Is that in part because cities are not yet staffed up to do the inspections that need to take place because it's such a specialized item?
I think you hit the nail on the head there. I mean, most electricians and most of the inspectors and people who look at the permits, our electricians have never dealt with solar before. They've never touched a battery before. They've never dealt with the setup and design we use to construct solar. And often, frankly, we are more expert than they are. So we often, to be honest, reach out to them and say, how can we teach you about solar so you can do a better job in permitting and inspecting what we do? Because we want to have high standards as an industry.
That must be frustrating.
It is. I mean, it's not uncommon to have an inspector come along to a job, and with the best will in the world, he or she will look at what we do and say, oh, so this is solar. How does it work?
An inspector.
An inspector.
Yeah, that's not what you want to hear.
Yeah.
Another strategy, the facilitation of investment in solar energy. And that's an interesting one. And again, that implies that there might be a problem.
Yeah, one of the good things about Kentucky is it has relatively low energy costs, compared with the U.S. kind of average. Saying that, from an investment and a return on investment point of view, your average homeowner who puts a reasonable size system on their house can expect to see payback in the 10 to 11 kind of year kind of area. So, you know, for a system that lasts, and I think this will surprise people, for a system that lasts 40 years, you basically get 75% of the life on free energy after your payback.
Now, one approach connected to that that's now moving forward with the blessings of the Urban County Council involves group purchasing or bulk buying discounts. Now, how does this work? What does the discount for the individual homeowner look like?
The discount is typically around kind of 15% or more. And it's arrived at simply by effectively a competition that's been fostered by Solarize Lexington to pit qualified installers against each other. And the best qualified and those that can offer the lowest prices are employed to serve the city. And luckily in this case, that was ourselves. We've done similar campaigns in Bloomington, in Evansville, Indiana, in Cincinnati, kind of Ohio. And it really gets people over the hump. They look at solar and think, maybe a little bit too expensive to me. You give them 15 to 20% discount, they'll join the movement and they'll really realize the benefits pretty quickly.
So how much does it typically cost to install a residential solar system?
I mean, for an average home in Kentucky, which is around 1,800 to 2,000 kind of square feet, to cover 95 to 100% of their energy needs in their home, you're probably looking at about $18,000 to $20,000 for a fully kind of featured system. Now, that's the gross price. The good thing is, at the moment, and certainly for the balance of this year, you get a 30% federal tax credit. So $20,000 kind of before tax credit, $14,000, $15,000 after kind of tax credit.
And that tax credit expires at the end of 2019?
Not entirely. It starts to step down. I mean, the tax credit was started in 2005 to give a boost to a very small industry in those days. And now it's being phased out in the belief that the industry can stand on its own two feet, which frankly is entirely true. So it's 30% this year. It steps down by just 4% next year, 4% the year after, then goes away entirely. Unless you're a business, well, it will stay at 10%. So it's starting to sunset, in other words.
To what extent does the return on the homeowner or the business owner's investment in solar power depend on selling power to the utility?
Well, the first thing I'd say is, nobody in Kentucky ends up selling power to utility. The utility acts as your bank. The way solar operates is, you have a set of panels on your roof. The intention is to provide 100% of your energy over a full calendar year. So often you'll make more energy than you need in the summer, and you'll bank that and you'll claim it back and consume it in the winter. So what a utility does for you, KU or LG&E, is they credit you with your overproduction. You then get back that credit. Nobody's being cut a check. Nobody's having their solar kind of bought. It basically sits there in a bank for you to take back yourself. You can't monetize it in that sense.
How can the homeowner or the business owner figure out if they have enough sunlight to make the investment worthwhile?
I mean, most homeowners have got a good feel for the direction of their home, the amount of shading on their home, but it's a technical subject and an engineering subject, and what we try and do is take that load off people. So imagine you wanted to think about solar on your house. You would ring us up. We initially would use satellite imaging to look at your house, look at the roof, look at the trees around it. And we have the software in our business and the engineering capability to almost model and mimic the sun around your house and do a power calculation on how much your roof could produce in terms of energy per year. And then we can have a discussion about, for this kind of system costs X amount of dollars, but we can tell you what your home would produce sometimes without visiting it. And then if it's something we want to do, we then come and take a detailed look at the home, the electrics, the structural ability of the home to bear the solar, et cetera. But first off, remotely, very simple.
What about batteries? Is it a good idea to consider storage batteries?
Batteries are something we've done a number of over the years, but it's fascinating to see batteries are starting to do what solar did 10 years ago, which is decrease in price rapidly. Yeah, we can thank Mr. Musk, yeah, for his kind of efforts on that. That's going to spark this growth in the EV or electric car industry. Battery prices more than halved in the last few years alone. So, you know, we're now starting to install a significant amount of batteries, particularly Tesla batteries, in the home as a backup or for people who say, look, I want to produce my own solar and I want to keep it inside my four walls. I don't want to give it to anybody. I don't want to be using electricity that's generated from dirtier sources. So people buy batteries for a number of reasons. They're here. They're starting to happen.
I know there are a number of stereotypes out there about solar power. For example, that solar energy is often viewed as an option for upper-income Kentuckians in large urban areas.
Yes.
Is that accurate?
An argument that was, you know, routinely kind of trotted out in the last 2 years of fights over solar in Frankfurt, and frankly, completely untrue. I tend to rely on facts, so when that kind of claim is made, I went to consumer research to look at the facts. The latest set of consumer research on who buys solar shows it is a 70% middle class purchase in the U.S., solidly middle class kind of purchase.
Tell us about some examples of how it's being used in rural areas. Mm. One example that I've seen is called People's Self-Help Housing in Tollsboro.
Yes. I mean,
what's that about?
In rural areas, we get a couple of different uses of solar. The more kind of obvious ones, to some degree, is for farmers. They're very big users of solar. These are men and women who are very cost conscious, who are running grain dryers or hog sheds or chicken sheds. And they love the prospect of putting up large solar arrays, which they get further tax credits for as operating businesses that make it very, very attractive for them to do so. Farm solar is a very big kind of growth area. On the nonprofit and low-income area, we're often finding that many of these, you know, organizations, be they, you know, nonprofit surgeries or housing trusts, or church organizations, have much higher utility costs than the rest of the state. You look to Eastern Kentucky, you know, a low income and challenged area, they are paying some of the highest utility costs in Kentucky, 40% above what, you know, you and I would pay in Lexington or Louisville. So solar makes even more sense to those locations. And we've done a number of projects on, you know, churches and community organizations that are allowing them to pay almost no electricity bill and divert those funds to good works in their parishes. That I love to see.
I mentioned earlier that Solarize Lexington is beginning a series of workshops. Where can we go to find out about those?
Yes, there's 10 kind of great workshops kind of going to be scheduled over the next kind of couple of months. Solarize Lexington is going to do library, church hall kind of meetings where you can come along, learn about solar and decide if it's something you want to actually have somebody come around and look at your small business or home to see if it kind of works for you. There's a great Facebook site that's been put together called Solar Kentucky. So if you go and look for that on Facebook, you'll find all the details about the campaign, locations and times of the meetings as well. And those are going to be updated almost daily with new information.
Steve Ricketts, he's co-owner of Solar Energy Solutions and a member of the Kentucky Solar Industry Association. And we thank you for joining us, Steve.
Oh, it's been a real pleasure. Thank you.
Tonight is funky. The sun is here. Come on, people. Have no fear.
We're here. Funky.
Coming up after the break, hear all about the Ralph Steadman exhibition coming soon to the UK Art Museum. If you listen all the way through, you'll find out why there's an objectionable content warning at the very beginning. Hint, Hunter S. Thompson. And performance artist Sean Leonardo had been watching TV,
witnessing what I experienced as the demise of political debates. And the way we once understood debates was devolving into simply a strategy of proving one side right over another.
Out of this revelation developed a version of debate that relies on body language instead of words, and it's coming to Lexington soon. I'm Tom Martin, and you're listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.
Eastern Standard is made possible by One, the AllTech Ideas Conference. One is an incubator of innovation, a forum for future thinkers, and a platform for propelling forward the promise of a planet of plenty. Attendees view technology as a transformative opportunity for their businesses and lives in order to make a difference in the world. Learn more about 119 in Lexington, May 19th through 21st, 2019, at one.alltech.com.
Major support for Eastern Standard on WEKU is provided by the law firm Hicks & Funson. Kentucky lawyers Josh Hicks, Greg Funson, and Shannon Church provide legal advice and representation in the areas of personal injury, catastrophic accident, and immigration law. Learn more at hfkylawyers.com. Eastern Standard continues with Tom Martin.
Coming soon to the University of Kentucky Art Museum, a fun and interesting retrospective of the work of Ralph Steadman. Art Sheckett of our arts partner Undermain got the details from museum curator Janie Welker. And a warning here, some listeners may find the content of a letter read during this segment to be a little objectionable.
Hi, Janie.
Hey, Art.
Why don't you tell us about Ralph Steadman and how he became famous and what his body of work has been?
I'd love to. Ralph Steadman is such an interesting character. A lot of people really know him from his time that he spent working with Hunter S. Thompson, the Gonzo journalist, and his coverage of the Kentucky Derby and Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas and various other pieces that he did with him. But Ralph really has had a very long career, and he really came up in the 1960s in England. He's English. Actually, he's Welsh by birth. And he came up in the 1960s in the rebirth of the satire movement in England, and a lot of publications like Private Eye, which was really interested in a lot of social satire at that point in time. He's an interesting guy. His first training in art was through a correspondence school for press artists, for cartoonists.
So he didn't have a formal arts education?
Not until then. He went to Percy V. Bradshaw's Press Art School by correspondence, and he sold his first cartoon in 1955, just a year after he started drawing, really, cartoons, to the Manchester Evening Chronicle, and it was on the Suez Canal incident and everything that was going on there. And he was very successful pretty fast in getting jobs in cartooning for newspapers. But he was really interested in doing commentary that was a little more profound, that could tackle a wider range of subjects. And so he continued studying. He went to the East Ham Technical College in London, and he met an instructor there who really encouraged him to study more widely, to look at literature, to look at art, to look at art history, to look at philosophy and music and, you know, different forms of culture, and who was very influential in his kind of learning. And Steadman started going to museums and sketching from art there, but also looking at a wide variety of the arts. He's always been interested in music. He's done album covers from the 1950s to the last one he did was just a year ago. He did a hip-hop cover.
So he's still active.
He's still very active. He's drawing all the time. And we have work that really goes through, I think, 2015. We have work from the 1950s, from that first cartoon that got published through 2015.
Now, many of us who are in the boomer generation first became familiar with Ralph's work through drawings he did for Rolling Stone, and
right,
then his work that he did illustrating Hunter Thompson's pieces,
yeah,
and his books. And he has a very stylistically recognizable form. Can you tell us something about how he developed his style and what it's about?
Yeah. You know, his style is very... For lack of a better word, his style is very artistic. I mean, he does a lot of pen and ink drawing. He does a lot of splatters. It's very expressionistic. He uses a wide range of, inks and pigments and watercolor. He sometimes even does collage. So he's not what you think of typically as a cartoonist, but as someone who uses kind of a very... kind of wide range of materials and a wide range of styles. He's really interested in materials, I think. He became interested in printmaking, and so sometimes he inserts things that he's printed on a press that he bought in 1961 and still using. So whatever works best, I think, for what he wants to get across.
The work with Hunter Thompson really reflects this very close relationship that he and Hunter developed. And one of the artifacts that you have in this show are some correspondence between Hunter and Ralph. And I'll just read an excerpt from one of them from June of 1970. And Hunter is writing to Ralph and he says, "Dear Ralph, you filthy, twisted pervert, I'll beat your ass like a gong for that drawing you did of me. You bastard, stay out of Kentucky from now on, and Colorado too. Bleep you." So tell us about the relationship between gonzo journalist Hunter Thompson and Ralph Steadman. They seem to be a perfect pairing.
I think they really were a perfect pairing. Ralph has said that he felt that working with Hunter gave him an edge that he didn't have prior to that. And Hunter, even later on in that letter that you read, talks about how much he enjoyed working with him and that he wants his agent to try to sell he and Ralph as kind of a partnership to work on future articles. So, you know, they worked really well together. They had a lot of adventures together. They went to Kinshasa for the Rumble in the Jungle, the fight between Ali and Foreman. And there are some great illustrations from there, but there was never a story because Hunter sold the tickets for some weed and some alcohol, and they spent the time at the pool. So they never actually saw the fight. They saw it in their hotel room, but they didn't see it in person. So they've had quite a few adventures together. And I think that Hunter was always a bit farther out there than Ralph. But I think that the thing that they had in common, when you think about journalism at that point in time and how it was changing, this kind of pretense of being unbiased was going away. And it went away. In Hunter Thompson's case, it went really far away. It really comes from the fact that he treated journalism almost like writing fiction and using a lot of those same techniques. And it was very personal. He made no pretense of being unbiased in any way. It was very personal and a lot of what we would call color. And so Steadman was so great at picking up the vibe and what was going on and kind of encapsulating it in one or two sketches that said so much about what Hunter was trying to say. So I think that was a really good pairing.
Yeah, and Ralph's style, which sort of was very maniacal and explosive and kind of madcap and demonic at times.
It was demonic at times, yeah.
Really fitted what Hunter was doing in his journalistic pieces.
Yeah, it was very expressionist, his style. And it's interesting because his inspiration was were artists like George Gross and Max Beckmann, who were working in Germany during the Weimar, kind of doing social criticism and political criticism.
So during the early part of the 20th century.
Yeah, the early part of the 20th century. And so here was Steadman coming up in the 60s and everything that was happening, not just in America, but in England then. That was like kind of like ground zero for a lot of the change that was happening, and really criticizing existing institutions, you know, kind of looking at counterculture, but also taking aim at counterculture as well. I mean, he didn't really pull any punches.
Nobody was safe.
No one was safe. There's a great cartoon that we were having, great piece that we have in the show that's called Weekend at West Wittering. And West Wittering is where Keith Richards had his home. Keith Richards of the Rolling Stones. And it was a raid. It was a police raid at West Wittering. And you can see George Harrison and Patty Boyd sneaking out the door as the police wait to go in because they're just after the Stones. And so it's kind of interesting. Yeah, no one was safe.
So let's talk about this show. How did the show come to the the museum?
It was really interesting because the Stedman Foundation organized a show, and they really wanted to get it to places in the country. They were interested in university museums. They were interested in places that had special relationships with Stedman, which we certainly do in Kentucky because of the Kentucky Derby element, Hunter Thompson, but also some of his work was printed here in Lexington by Joe Petro.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Who is a printer. Yeah, we have works in our collection that were printed by him. So there's a lot of close connections here. And Sadie, Ralph's daughter, told us that she had gotten a personal recommendation for the art museum. And so they came out to see us, and we talked about the show. And because we're not taking very many traveling exhibitions these days, we're very picky about what we do take. But this was such an extraordinary opportunity. It was such a, you know, kind of a range of work, kind of historical and contemporary. But also for us, we haven't really done this kind of cartoon / political satire, that kind of work in the museum for a while, certainly not on this scale. And we initially were going to have the show in the summer, but then we found that the students were really upset, and we didn't really expect the students to know who he was as much as some of us of more mature years. But it turns out they do. I mean, because of the hip hop cover, because he did the illustrations for the box set of Breaking Bad. And they all know who he is. I mean, he's still as popular today. So we moved it. We actually called them and moved the show so it was during the school year. And I think it's going to be a really good teaching tool, as well as just being really fun to look at.
So tell us just about one or two pieces that are in the show.
It's really fun to see some of his early drawings, which are, there's the early cartoons, but the drawings, which are really beautiful, and showing him sketching in a pub or sketching in museums. One of the things that really surprised me is that I knew he had done book illustration, but I didn't realize the degree to which he had done book illustration.
Didn't he do Fahrenheit 451 and Alice in Wonderland?
He did Alice in Wonderland, actually, on two different occasions. And so he did also a lot of other children's books that are kind of really magical. But he did a book on Sigmund Freud and the interpretation of jokes. And then he did a book on Leonardo da Vinci, who he's admired since childhood. And he wrote the book from the standpoint of being da Vinci, with constructed quotes that were that he made up. So he's someone who, you know, he can react really quickly to a situation, but he's someone who also, in terms of book illustration, goes really deeply into it. At the same time, he's also been a commercial artist. Mm-hmm. He's done catalogs for a company that distributes wine and spirits, and so he's gone to distilleries and vineyards and labels for beer and things like that. So he's kind of done the full range, and I love the fact that he, you know, he's doing work for hire a lot of times, whether there are cartoons or whether it's something like that. And he is able to kind of bring his own touch to it.
So we'll be able to see a wide range of his work. The show opens February 16th?
The show opens February 16th.
And how long does it go for?
It goes until May 5th.
Okay.
And we have a public reception from 7 to 8:30 on Friday, February 15th. There's a members reception before that at the museum. And then the show opens the following day on Saturday, the 16th, and runs until May 5th.
So there'll be plenty of time for folks to get down there to the UK Art Museum for the Ralph Stedman retrospective. This should be a really fun, interesting, and illuminating show. Hope lots of folks get down there. Thanks again, Janie Welker.
Thank you.
Wordless Debate is coming to Lexington.
The premise of this piece is to look at the ways that debate has devolved. We now occupy a time and space where communication has devolved to a strategy of proving oneself right. And I knew there was potential in enacting a series of workshops with four divided groups that we read as divided around a central issue, as gun violence, and bring them then to a moment of reckoning,
to debate one another without using words.
That's the voice of Sean Leonardo from a video about primitive games his recent social practice commission concerning gun violence staged at the Guggenheim Museum in New York. Sean uses performance practice to unravel the complexities of human interaction. And he's coming to Transylvania University on February 27th as part of Transy's Creative Intelligence series. And he joins us now from New York. Hi, Sean.
How are you?
I'm very good and very interested in what you do. Communicating points of view through body language, not words. How did you arrive at this concept?
Well, two things started to happen concurrently. First, the concept of primitive games really arrived when I discovered Calcio Storico, which is still currently played in Florence, Italy, but originated during the Roman Empire as a way to keep their soldiers in shape between battle, and has sort of evolved into a sporting event. And while I was taking this in and really studying it as a sport that really enacts violence for the sake of violence, it has very few rules, I was also, of course, glued to the television and witnessing what I experienced as the demise of political debate. And the way we once understood debate was devolving into simply a strategy of proving one side right over another. And I started to really see how, in some strange ways, the physicality of the sport, one of the most brute sports in my opinion, modeled or paralleled some of the tactics being used in verbal debate, verbal sparring, if you will. And I started to decode what was in front of me and realized that there was maybe something there. And I really wanted to enact a large-scale performance where seemingly divided teams had to deal and reckon with each other on completely different terms, that they could not fall back on the default language that was maybe passed on to them as group affiliations and as individuals to defend their positionality.
So does this sharpen the individual's ability to literally read the other person through the movements of their body or their posture or the positioning?
That's exactly right. So what I'm trying to argue is by first understanding how our own bodies activate when faced with opposition, when faced with an individual, even just simply upon encounter, when faced with an individual that we perceive as being an opponent or other, by understanding what our bodies do, whether that's a scripted choreography, a learned by training, or sort of an innate posturing that we subconsciously enact, by knowing how our body moves when faced with this type of resistance, type of opposition, whether it's real or perceived, we might better understand what is happening in someone else, in that person that we're seeing as an opposition. And it's so really the process is in identifying oneself in the other, in quotes, so as to find a common ground, so as to find some connectivity that will allow us to move beyond words and understand that there is a meeting ground. And that is precisely where I think debate is failing us today, that when starting with words, and I do believe that this has worsened in the last 5 to 10 years, but when starting with words, actually what we fall back on is all the speaking points that we've been prepared or rehearsed to argue and, again, defend our position, so that we're not really speaking with intentionality, nor are we allowing ourselves to see, in both literal and metaphorical terms, the other person. So communication fails before it has even begun.
So given what you've told us and the experiences that you've had, would you say that generally we pay too little attention to body language, or are we actually doing it, but we don't really realize it?
I think we've lost touch in more than one way. I think, yes, what I think requires training is not only being attuned to what body language is telling us and really sensing a truth in what is being conveyed in one another's body language, but also I think, generally speaking, because of the pace of life today, and other factors, including social media,
that we are losing a connection between mind and body. And so more often than not, we are relying on language to express our views, but we're not really putting ourselves and our bodies on the line. So in that, we, in some really terrifying ways, are moving further and further away from each other and sensing each other's humanity. It's only by reinventing platforms of simply existing together that we might find that interconnectivity once again. And my argument is that language or words is the very thing that often gets in the way. And so that we have to really think through and reevaluate how we debate and how we simply engage one another. And that's where I've arrived to at Primitive Games.
Sean Leonardo, whose performance practice Primitive Games was created as a means of unraveling the complexities of human interaction. He'll be in Lexington on February 27th for a 7:30 p.m. performance in Transylvania's Carrick Theater as part of the university's Creative Intelligence Series. Thanks so much, Sean.
Thank you so much. I look forward to seeing many of you out there.
You can watch a video of Sean Leonardo's Primitive Games on our website. Just go to esweku.com and click on the Facts and Information tab. On next week's edition of Eastern Standard, our next episode of Humans of Central Appalachia, Katina Haynes, CEO of the Kaywood Ledford Boys and Girls Club in Harlan, Kentucky, on those stereotypes.
I have a master's degree. My husband has a master's degree. He's a librarian. You know, we're educated. We have plumbing and windows and floors in our homes. And for people to generalize to an entire community and kind of discount them as a whole because they view them as uneducated and impoverished is really disheartening.
You'll hear from a group in another community in the region who are out to change the narrative about Eastern Kentucky, beginning with TEDx Corbin. Organizer Crystal Kinzer will be here to fill us in. And an effort just getting underway to try to reverse declining enrollment of education majors at Kentucky universities training the next generation of teachers.
Having the loan forgiveness program makes it possible for many students who are interested in coming to college and interested in teacher education to pursue their goal and their dream.
Dr. Sherry Powers, Dean of the EKU College of Education, joins us along with State Education Commissioner Wayne Lewis. These items and more on next week's edition of Eastern Standard. Well, that's all for this week. Eastern Standard is a broadcast service of Eastern Kentucky University, produced in the Lexington studios of Dynamics Productions with the support of ONE, the All-Tech Ideas Conference, a global nexus of innovation for the future of food and the farm. Our executive producer is Mike Savage. Neil Kesterson is our producing engineer and audio editor. Information about Eastern Standard content partnerships can be found online at esweku.com. Now you can listen to editions of Eastern Standard on the WEKU mobile app for iPhone and Android devices. Download the free WEKU app in the Apple Store or Google Play. Eastern Standard's also available as a podcast. You'll find us on NPR One, iTunes, Google Play, and Stitcher. We'd like to hear from you. You can email us at es@eku.edu. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.